Are you there, Brian?
I am.
Is it okay to call you Brian, or should we use your real name?
Well, we might as well go with Brian.
Yeah,
I was Brian last week. So.
Okay, yeah. Brian, I just have to commend your email to me is absolutely astounding. I haven't got an email like that with new information in, I don't know, since Dave Worster back in 68 or something. That's pretty incredible.
Oh, jeez.
What?
Oh, that's you flatter me.
Right. Now,
well,
you can
be McLuhan and Thompson, but yeah,
right.
It's nice to know that the like some cross quadrant direct communication there.
Good point. Very good point. Hey, Carolyn, are we coming through? Oh, she's half hour behind. Let's see, who else can we ask? Anybody here presently? Because I got a new phone, and it's sort of odd, the mute mechanism.
You sound fine, bro.
Okay, good, we're going through. Because, you know, it would show a little blank there, but okay, we'll do that later. Okay, so Brian, you gave me a lot of notes, excellent stuff. Would you like to orally approach it another way or pick what area you want to go into first? So what we're doing is Brian again reported at Fort Book in the University of Toronto, the Thomas Fisher Rare Book Library, to look at the newest dialogue in the cosmos, Marsh McLuhan talking to everybody about his reading and what he processed. And Brian has the luck of living there and to check it out. So where would you go? Want to begin with these massive details, Brian?
Well, I mean, the email you refer to is I sent you the complete notes of annotations of McLuhan in William Rowan Thompson, and which is basically it's unfortunate that that's the complete note. There were, I think, three Thompson books in the library. Two of them had no annotations. There was At the Edge of History and something else with no annotations. The only one which had any was The Imagination of an Insurrection, is Thompson's first book about the rebellion, about the literary and artistic background and milieu of the Irish Easter Rebellion around the time of World War
I. 1916. Let me just say something here.
Yeah.
You blipped out. It's The Imagination of a Resurrection? Is that what it's called?
Of an Insurrection.
Insurrection. A little side note. That comes out in... I don't know, the late 60s, early 70s. And then Thompson puts out a book called At the Edge of History, and he ties with the Whole Earth Catalog for a National Book Award or something. He gets a prize for it. And the Stuart Brand and the guys who did the Whole Earth Catalog were acquaintances of Thompson, which was interesting because he had gone to Esalen and met those guys. And he writes about that in his 1974 book, Passages About Earth, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, this one, at the time that... Hey, Karen, could you just sort of bring down the volume on your other speaker? Yeah. So the 1971 At the Edge of History, it's reviewed by Richard Needham in the Globe and Mail, and Thompson is declared the new McLuhan by a Toronto writer who would know McLuhan, you know, being a major reviewer in Toronto in the 60s. So that came out like a week or so before Thompson was taken to the Monday night seminar with Frank Zangroni. They were both teaching up at York. They had met at MIT. Frank got to York, and he brought Thompson up to MIT in, I don't know, 69, 70, 71, because Thompson wanted to get out of the Vietnam War mood in the divisions in MIT. So he is brought down to meet McLuhan, and McLuhan is distant with them. Nobody knows, I don't think, whether McLuhan had read that review where Thompson is declared the new McLuhan, obsolescing Marshall, and there was a bit of a distance, and Thompson never got over that. He left with not really connecting with McLuhan, and he decided he didn't like the Toronto scene, so he went to New York to start his commune called Lindisfarne, which eventually got supported by Lawrence Rockefeller. So that may be the background for why McLuhan didn't review, didn't even read the books. I'm not sure, you know what I mean? But that's just a little gossipy note about his relationship to one of the books that has no footnotes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's almost a good thing that there were no footnotes. It would be kind of, I mean, I thought at those second two books, At the Edge of History and Passages About Earth, are really, they're great books, and it's definitely very hyperbolic and pretty false to pretend that that obsolesces McLuhan, but
right.
I would have loved to have known what McLuhan said about it, but if he had that on his mind, he might have just been very dismissive or only wanting to, okay, I'm going to read this book and take all notes about how this is nowhere near me. Might have all been very negative. But maybe it's for the best.
All right.
The trouble is, though, that in the imagination of an insurrection, I wish I was here all ready to talk about that, but really the notes in there are a bit disappointing in terms that there's not too much. There's not very much of McLuhan content. There's a bit of a, you know, you get to see the things that he noticed and remarked on. He's got some notes and some underlinings and stuff, but what really stuck out to me is that there's no evidence that he read any further than page, like, 65 or something, which
right.
is really disappointing because it's Thompson's first book, and I believe it was a PhD thesis book
yes.
for literature or something. But it's really good. And,
yeah.
And you know, it very much deals with important topics of how art and politics and revolutionary politics intersect and all that. So I would have loved to have known what McLuhan thought of the rest of it. But
did you notice, okay, the Thompson... The main McLuhan principle Thompson takes, other than the obvious immediacy message, is that the previous environment gets turned into an art form. He uses that for the rest of his career, and I think he uses it in imagination of an insurrection. And McLuhan would be interested in someone taking that idea very quickly after Marshall said it in the mid-60s. So that's what's to look for, is if Marshall notices that. Now, do you want to go into the particular notes? Should I read what you wrote here to me? Is that
how? Well, I was thinking not really necessarily. I mean, unless we got all the time in the world, I wanted to talk about something else.
Oh, okay,
but,
go ahead. Yeah, we have all the time in the world, but you can go.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, we could get back to that if we wanted. But the what was a book that I was just looking at yesterday, which I was delighted to find that McLuhan clearly read the whole thing and has plenty of notes on the back cover, lots of, you know, page numbers with the themes beside it. He was clearly reading the whole thing very closely, is Earth in Upheaval by Emanuel Velikovsky.
Oh, yes. He talks about Velikovsky in Take Today, which comes out in 72. And
he does?
Yes, he refers
to it. I've got Take Today on my lap, and I was going to mention something from it, but I guess I hadn't gotten to the part where he actually mentions Velikovsky, but there's something related to that, where he talks about, for example, talking about the kind of grants economy, and that in a way that turns into its own method. It seems like just largesse or a nice thing that the government does, but then it turns into its own kind of trap, because everyone... school kids and postdoctoral researchers alike now wait anxiously for the renewal of their annual grants. For example, the top researcher knows he must not rock the academic boat or knock a great hole in the hull by some ill-advised discovery.
Now, that is what page in Take Today?
82.
Yeah, I think what he says about Velikovsky, you might look at the end, near the middle to the last third, I think he identifies himself with Velikovsky. Velikovsky goes a bit out of the off the grid and finds some new patterns, and McLuhan mm-hmm. says what happened to him, he implies what happened to Velikovsky happened to McLuhan. So
for sure.
You can look for that when you get there. But tell us the notes that are there, or a few of them.
Well, yeah, it's good that it was the third, that Earth and Upheaval was Velikovsky's third book, because that book also includes some of his reaction to how his first books were received, how Worlds in Collision was received. So there's a long, and Earth and Upheaval is from 1955, and Worlds in Collision was from 1950. So there's a longish section at the end where, you know, he gets off of his specific scientific topic to talk about the culture of science and basically is exhorting the reader to have courage and dare to follow the facts and just know that if you're right, but the truth is not fashionable, then the reaction will be as if you're crazy and just, you know, take courage and stick to the facts and what you know is right. It's a beautiful epilogue to the book about courage in the face of people not liking the truth and when the truth goes against the given paradigm.
Does McLuhan comment on it, on that part?
No, actually, the McLuhan's notes, well, the thing is I was just there yesterday for a couple hours, so I was only able to look at a couple of his specific references. But in terms of the page number notes, the page number notes stop basically just before that final section. Mm. So, I mean, I imagine that McLuhan probably read that, and, I mean, there's no written evidence that he took specific notes from it, but it's also something that he would have known all too well, perhaps.
Yes.
Although maybe not in the... If he read the book right after it came out, then he might not have really had his own experience with that so much yet, unless he had a version of that experience from the mechanical side or just the exploration stuff.
Right.
But there aren't any particular notes about that section, but the notes that I found very interesting are referring to, there's a couple of notes that use the shorthand C/M for center margin.
Yes, center and, width margins and center C hyphen margin is centers everywhere, margins nowhere, decentralization.
Right.
Yes. Exactly. Center slash yeah. M is center, is bureaucratic center with fringes and colonies and things like that.
Yeah, the difference between a center and a margin. And it's very important about how this book offers a great example, the notes to that book offer a great example of just how wide-ranging this idea is. And it's not, I don't know, I mean, I guess people could maybe fall into some more limited idea of the application of what McLuhan was talking about, but particularly this one note for page 269, origin of gradual center margin idea. And what that page is about is Velikovsky is tracing the building of the paradigm basically from the 1700s to the end of the 1800s.
Right.
Construction of this paradigm of general stability in the solar system, and the idea that all of the weirdness, all of what looks strange or anomalous in planetary orbits, that these are all deviations from a norm, that the normal kind of Newtonian orbit is the rule, and that is the reality, mm-hmm. and that whatever doesn't fit with that can be explained away as a marginal difference.
Put on the margin.
Yeah, exactly. And why this is really important to Velikovsky is, it's obviously important to Velikovsky because his main subject is the geological history of the Earth and, by extension, the solar system and this catastrophic history, but he talks about how this paradigm of general stability with only slight deviations, was extremely important, in fact, completely necessary for the biological paradigm of the vast, vast, vast timescales required for the Darwinian paradigm of gradual evolution. And, right.
Let me just a couple of points there. First of all, the last section that McLuhan doesn't have any notes on, that is what he comments on in Take Today. So it'll be interesting when you
right.
discover that later in the book. In the recording I played last week, I don't know if you heard it, he explains more than he wrote why Darwin was obsolete, and the biological metaphor becomes biological theater by the time of Burroughs. What McLuhan said in the 19th century, the vast times of biology in the Darwinian paradigm were acceptable because they were big enough to contain the flood of new scientific data and facts or non-facts that were coming in the 19th century, you know, with the telegraph and that. So just want to point out that you're saying that the stage before that was creating vast spaces, which McLuhan comments way back in Criticism that Pascal was depressed by the infinite spaces unveiled after Newton's paradigm came in. You know, the universe swallowed up people. And you're saying, but those vast solar spaces were necessary for the biological huge timings for Darwin. That's what you're saying?
Well, yes, particularly necessary for the evolution for the non-catastrophe paradigm.
Yeah.
Because Velikovsky's idea, and it's much more accepted now, is this idea, I guess it's known as punctuated evolution or something, the paradigm where evolution, there are periods where it happens, there's a lot of evolution and rapid change and new species arise really quickly. Because the Darwinian slow evolution paradigm involves these very small changes, and the idea would be that you would have to have these incredibly long timescales for very small fragmentary changes to actually build up into a new species at all, let alone for that species to then get selected to survive. And people had the idea that you would have to have a kind of a Galapagos situation with species being separated from each other in order to maintain that at all, whereas Velikovsky is coming in and not only providing evidence that these catastrophes did occur, but commenting that, you know, this makes the whole evolutionary picture make a lot more sense if there were gigantic bursts of radiation, for one thing, to create lots of mutations at once to actually have a new species emerge, and also to create the really intense sudden environmental pressures to select out these new species. But
let me respond there. I don't know if it's coming up, but I'll be playing tonight a McLuhan speech from 67 or so, or it was played last week. I can check my notes later. Is that McLuhan says that Darwin was rearview mirror studying thumbs, fingers, and appendages of the human and of animals to come up with his limited biological evolution metaphor. And McLuhan said that was rather static compared to the technological evolution that was coming into the 20th century with the electric age. And he says, even though Darwin deals with vast stretches of time, millions of years are transformed in a few seconds by the electric world. In a few seconds, millions of years are upset. So that's what I've never seen or heard McLuhan write or say that, because, you know, this stuff I'm playing, no one's ever heard before. It's incredible the stuff that's in there. But what a great statement, you know, that the electric age, well, basically we were becoming disembodied. The biological metaphor wasn't even visible. It's like what Ian says, what you see isn't real. What you can't see, the electric age, is real. So Velikovsky, and since you had a solid reinforcement by the peasants becoming educated after World War II, you know, the GI Bill, so everybody goes to university, so the visual press effect, the printing press effect, really gets slammed into the working class. It's so solid, even though it's underneath shady, that Velikovsky represents the shaking up of that by the electric media by taking that solid historical Darwinian landscape and saying there's a rupture in it, a discontinuity. See, just to even put that in is how solid the biological metaphor was required to be for it to topple the church's ideas. So those are just timely ideas of what you brought up, which always happens here at Dobstown and Eindhoven, that you happen to look up that guy, and it totally fits in to what I was listening to 2 days ago, the Darwin thing. So, get your next idea, next point.
Also another thing, this book was the first time that I saw this shorthand that looking at the library catalog, they give you a list of a little key to McLuhan's shorthands at the top. And one of them I hadn't seen yet was 20/B, referring to things for the, which never happened, the 20th century Baedeker project.
Right. Yeah, that was his updating of Understanding Media. He was going to write a newer encyclopedia, and he never got that done because it flipped into the Tetrad discovery, and that became more important than another encyclopedia. But you're saying that B20/B means before the Baedeker or about the Baedeker? What is it?
It means this, like, that would be good for the Baedeker.
Yeah, the history of the 20th century.
Right, and the page, the particular page that he puts that note on is a page where Velikovsky is talking. This is right at the it's the last note that McLuhan gives is right at the beginning of Velikovsky's long speech about, you know, have stick to the facts and don't forget the haters or whatever.
Right.
It's a page where he's talking about how in 1895... there was a quest for the North Pole. Someone was going to find the North Pole. And he's saying, and at that time, the scientific world looked upon the discovery of the North Pole as the most coveted goal still left to be attained by science.
Wow.
Like, at the end of the 1900s, like, right as, while the, you know, the electric environment has started to come in, but it hasn't really, you know, had its effects haven't really become very conscious yet.
Yeah.
You're getting this the climax of the print mentality, of the center margin mentality. There was very much this idea that, you know, we've got all the basics and all that's left is a few things on the margins. And it's very, and the whole academic scandal thing, the academic conspiracy that just comes from the very nature of it, and it doesn't really require anyone's particular malice, but just the very nature of it, of this center margin pattern, comes down to this idea that the center we've got, we just need to clean up a few things on the edges. Like, the North Pole at the margins of what's accessible to us, well, we'll go find that, but everything else is taken care of.
Yeah, and the homeless. We got to clean up the homeless, which would be the Arctic Circle. Let me add a point here. The you know, people rebel against authority. Ayn goes on about authority versus power, and they go against authority, and they try to establish their power if they don't get too distracted by fighting authority. But authority came in, and what people rebel against is the print effect, center margin. Because the print effect, you know, from 1600 on was a novelty, people wanted to wallow in the effect. And the wallowing effect was, let's have a central printed authority. A guy writes a book, and everybody, including the margins, have to subsume themselves around the center medium that comes out, this center item. The center margin structure is a natural effect of the printing press, that era. And if you start being pissed off about authority, you're just reacting to something that disappeared 100 years ago. The book stopped being, you know, a center margin reinforcement 100 years ago. And as McLuhan said, Joyce was the last novel, and that put it away. But the this is important to realize that the authority is a natural product of the printing press, and it makes people enjoy having a central figure and the margins being defunded. Of course, that all flips with the electric age, and then everybody wants to take their decentralized autonomy and power, and that is the basic eye-ear dialectic that McLuhan can cover 500 years with. So I just wanted to put that in there, because authority versus power comes up a lot. If you're pissed off at authority, you're stuck in your eye. If you're celebrating your power, you're stuck in your ear. The tactility is the interplay of both of them. Okay.
Sure, okay.
All right.
That makes sense.
Right. Now, go ahead.
Another a fortuitous timing thing in terms of this theme of fleshing out just the vast scope of what McLuhan means by the center margin and center without margins is I didn't know before I got it out. I had no way of knowing whether, for all I knew, I'd open the Velikovsky book and there'd be only two notes and it wouldn't have gotten past the introduction and I'd still have an hour and a half on my hands with nothing to do. So
yeah.
I also got out Buckminster Fuller's Utopia or Oblivion.
Good.
And which had a fair amount of annotations in it. And because I was looking at the Velikovsky, I definitely didn't have any more that I just very quickly looked through. I was captivated by these center margin themes, so I just looked in Utopia Oblivion for that.
Yeah.
And there's a fairly perfect note where In Utopia or Oblivion, one of McLuhan's notes on the back cover is, page 39, in 1927, set out to be C-M via Navy. So set out to be center without margins, or centers everywhere, margins nowhere. And when you look on the page 39, it's Fuller saying, quote, I set out deliberately to be a comprehensivist in 1927. So McLuhan very clear, direct, explicit substitution of C-M rather than C/M.
Yeah.
We'll say C-M, the center without margins note, for Fuller's comprehensivist. So, and comprehensivist rather than specialist, Fuller talks about how everywhere was this specialism. And so the idea of the authority and the academic authority is totally tied up in this idea of being a specialist.
Yeah.
And that people like Velikovsky and, say, Wilhelm Reich, that what made them such a scandal is that they crossed genre, but they crossed specialties. That, you know, Reich was a psychologist and he starts getting into biology, and Velikovsky was, I don't remember exactly what he was, but the geology or history, one of the things he talked about was not really his supposed specialty, the one little narrow box that he was allowed to be an authority on. That this idea that you're getting out of your box is, the idea that that's bad is a center margin idea.
Yeah.
You know, stay in your center. No, that's a marginal territory to you. You have no authority there. But the instinct that, of course, can find facts and new ideas and enough new theories to write a whole book about anywhere in a different specialty is the center without margins idea. So it's just interesting that, it's just perfect that whereas in the Velikovsky, he's talking about the center margin idea, not just with planetary orbits and the stability of the solar system, there being a basic stability with only minor variation, marginal variations, but that it's particularly related to the origin of species, because then you get it with the specialization and the special subject, and you've got a particular species of expertise, and there's no crossing the boundaries there.
Okay, this 1927 is very... Oh, one thing, McLuhan used to say that something meant crossing boundaries, that it was a violent act. I don't know what the theme was, but I think just searching for knowledge is a violent act because you're crossing boundaries. So that's what I think of when you talk about the specialist moving into the comprehensivist. Okay, 1927, wasn't that the year Bucky Fuller tries to commit suicide or seriously contemplated it? Do you know that story?
Oh, I definitely know the story. I'm not sure if that was exactly that year.
Yeah. Okay, saying approximately around that time.
Yeah.
So here's he saying, as an idea, I'm going to be a comprehensivist. McLuhan says, no, it's the ground that Bucky adopted, the Navy. McLuhan talks about the water technologies are decentralized, whereas the land-based technologies and empires are center margin, more locked into the bureaucracy. They're more free-floating in the seas. So it's interesting. I don't know if Bucky says, I want to be a comprehensivist, so I must go to the medium of comprehensibility potential, so I will join the Navy. He probably doesn't say that, but McLuhan is pointing out the medium that Bucky is taking on to be a comprehensivist. See, that's an interesting distinction there.
Well, Bucky was already in the Navy, and I believe in the book, in Utopia or Oblivion, he presents it as being fortuitous that he was in the Navy, because the Navy was the Navy schools was the only place in all of academia where you could actually deliberately try to become some kind of a comprehensivist, that they actually had a school for that kind of thing.
Oh, okay, so the curriculum tended towards that. All right.
Right. And nowhere else in the world but the Navy did the curriculum actually allow for that. So that makes perfect sense.
Right. So McLuhan is just expanding it or making it slightly deeper. Yes, the Navy does that, but that is a center minus margin structure, center without margin structure, Bucky, is what he's saying to Bucky. You know, your medium, that's natural to have that in the Navy. It's not because the Navy picked a curriculum, a particular non-specialist curriculum. I think that's what he's trying to do. I'm trying to give McLuhan the benefit of making a distinction, an important distinction that Bucky is not pointing out.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that that seems to map up. I mean, like, I can't really be sure because, like I said, I only looked at it very quickly. I was like, well, I only have 10 minutes left before I ran off to this other lecture, so I'll look quickly at Utopia or Oblivion, and then I zeroed in on the center margin note.
Oh, how was the lecture?
With Eric McLuhan and Bruce Powell.
Yes. Any comments on that?
It was good. I mean, Bruce Powell was talking about his new book, basically just a brief multimedia overview version of his new book about McLuhan and Fry.
Yeah.
And Northrop Fry. So that was, and I had already seen the same, a slightly longer version of the same lecture at the book launch the previous week. So it
so
was.
What did Eric do? Did Eric argue or reinforce?
No, actually, Eric came on first and wasn't really responding to, he wasn't really talking specifically to the McLuhan and Fry idea at all. He was just giving his own little lecture. I could whip out the notes. One thing that, I noticed, Eric McLuhan is very, he likes talking about things being in fours. He's talking about that there's four ways of expressing yourself with the body, and one of those is posture, and there's four fundamental types of posture, and there's four fundamental types of alphabets, and that kind of thing. So
well, you know where he's getting that from? That's from the late Wayne Constantino, which after Wayne died, I don't know, 10 years ago, Eric took his unfinished manuscripts and spruced them up and got them published. You can find a series of books, small booklets that Eric did, solidifying Wayne's ideas of the four body postures as the key to everything. And that's actually to his latest book, so that's why he's talking about it. Now, here's the hidden plot, though. Eric does not like the emphasis on the Gnostic McLuhan that Bruce Powell brings into McLuhan studies. And if you remember back in 2004, when there was the McLuhan Festival and Bruce gave a talk, Eric walked out on it. And that was Friday afternoon at the Drake. So I was hoping Eric would, take on Bruce, but he didn't. So that's disappointing.
At this event anyway, you would have gotten no impression, if you didn't know anything else, you would have gotten no impression at all that they were anything but friends and mutually respectful colleagues in knowledge and et cetera, and McLuhan studies and everything. They were, they were very much seeming friendly.
Well, they are friends, but Eric objects to the William Irwin Thompson quadrant, which Bruce is very influenced by. William Irwin Thompson's McLuhanism, or how he fits McLuhanism into Buddhism and those things and the esoteric wisdoms, Bruce is a follower of that, and Eric is not a fan of Thompson. So it's almost like Eric's keeping the anti-Thompson thing going that Marshall, his father, started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can definitely... definitely sense that about, it's pretty clear that, that Powell is, likes the kind of more Gnostic side. And I guess that helps with him to, because Powell very much maintains he tries to kind of maintain a neutrality even between the McLuhan and Fry thing of who's better, when it's kind of obvious that one of them's a lot better. But, Fry may have been a Christian or whatever, but still something about, Gnostic Christian. He wasn't a Catholic Christian. Like, the whole great code of the Bible and all of that is a much more, maybe it's just not based on fours enough to be...
No, there's the four. Thompson has the four. Northrop Frye has the four in his books. Okay. Now, the thing is that Northrop Frye is more interested in and hypnotized by the quadrant, William Irwin Thompson quadrant topics, like he writes about acupuncture and the tarot and things like that, that Marshall wouldn't say too much publicly about. But the Fry is more of the mystic, Gnostic than McLuhan is. Now, a couple honest statements by Bruce Powell. He says this book, McLuhan and Fry, fails. He failed to do whatever he thought he was trying to do. That would require an interview about why he thought he failed. And he also says that's the end of his thinking about McLuhan and Fry. He's moving on to newer things if he can come up with stuff. I mean, he is a novelist and poet too, but it's a marker for him of stopping that kind of thinking, even though he teaches at university.
One thing that he said, not 2 days ago, but in the previous longer book launch lecture, one thing that he mentioned, another thing that he failed to do, and he was making it the clear subtext was, I consider this subject closed, was that he had failed to find any substantial evidence for the idea that some people like to believe that there was a Masonic conspiracy to suppress McLuhan, and that Fry was a part of that, and that had something to do with the antagonism between them.
Hey, Bruce says that is not an issue and not proven. For him,
he says that he tried, that one of the things he was doing with this book even was to, like, if there's something to that, I want to find it. And his conclusion is that there's nothing to it, or at least nothing but, fragmentary circumstantial evidence that you would have to inflate in order to make something of it.
Yeah, I'd like to mention this just for the record. It shows a wide-ranging context that Bruce has. He announced this during the McLuhan centenary, maybe in Europe, maybe at Barcelona, where he works occasionally. He said that there is an agreement between CSIS, the Canadian CIA, and terrorist groups that they can have a safe house in Canada. They can live and plan and scheme in Canada as long as they don't blow up anybody in Canada. And that's why Canada has had no terrorism. And that's a very interesting point. I'm just putting it out there. If people think Bruce is some ninny, arguing over past figures like Northern Fry, no, he's in touch with things. And that's a very interesting statement that he made.
That's a very interesting statement, and it would have been high time to mention something about that at this lecture, because,
these lectures.
Let me just say that my reaction to the last few days in Canada is like, geez, you'd think we'd been attacked by terrorists, the way that everyone's acting about this one guy shooting guy in the Capitol and then running with his gun, which shouldn't have had any bullets left in it, into the Parliament building.
Yeah,
honestly, the impression you get from the Canadian media is like, wow, everyone here was like, they couldn't wait to experience a terrorist attack and pile on with the acting. Like, just from, if you didn't know what happened that day and were just listening to all the media reactions, then you'd think, wow, I guess, dozens of people died and something, blah, blah, blah.
Big stuff.
In a coordinated, like, geez. And the other world leaders were all talking about, like, we stand with the Canadians and blah, blah, blah. Like, we didn't have 50 people die from a bomb in our subway. We had a guy shot a guy. This was a murder by a nut.
Yeah,
like, just because and it's funny that people are talking about, people call it a terrorist attack. It seems the fact that he shot a soldier, rather than a uniformed soldier, somehow makes it more of a terrorist attack rather than a murder. The definition of terrorism is completely flipped on its head. It used to be targeting civilians indiscriminately was what made you a terrorist.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre, but it would have been high time for him to mention something about why we have no actual terrorist attacks in Canada.
That's right. Well,
Eric mentioned terrorism.
Right, and he should have mentioned the Bruce Powell thing, but you will not get a lively presentation to these things unless I'm there. Bruce did it in September 18th at York, and I made it lively in the question period. So I'm the only one who brings in the interesting, quote, facts about whatever they're trying to ignore or talk about. So,
it's worth saying that my one friend, I was the only guy I knew at the 2 days ago lecture.
Yeah.
I was sad not to see Mike Edmonds there, but so I basically didn't know anyone and just hung out with myself. But at the book launch the week before, I was there with a couple friends, one of whom had been at your channeling event at the Drake during the McLuhan Festival.
2004.
He said that one of his comments on Pow's lecture was that it made him miss you. It made him realize just how valuable your more anarchic, slackful, all over the place.
Yeah.
And boldly going where no, even a cool academic like Bruce Pow, because, I'm not trying to make Bruce Pow seem like a buttoned-down fuddy-duddy, but you make everyone seem that way, you know?
Yes, and what happened...
And I was like, well, Bob was just in town. He's like, I know, I just, what was I thinking, not doing it?
He could have come to dinner with you and Daniel Libby.
Yeah.
You know, but Bruce, I met him in Barcelona in the end of July for the second performance in their opening times theme they got going there at Barcelona, a particular part of the university. So I so inspired Bruce the day before in his office that he invited me to be part of it. Now, that hasn't been put up on YouTube, but it should be. But as a result of my interaction with Bruce, Bruce likes this kind of stuff. He said after he really missed that thing, and he was going to stop being so reclusive and get out there and interact with me as much as possible.
Cool.
So even Bruce... No, I will say Bruce is a wild and crazy guy if he gets the environment happening around him, but he becomes whatever
For sure.
it is, and so he just stayed responses. I mean, Marshawn didn't say much a week or so ago, you know, to Bruce. It was dull. And we hope to hear the recording.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not just trying to be polite when I say that I don't want to make it seem like he's some button-down fuddy-duddy guy. I mean, it's obvious he's not. Like,
right.
I read... Like, it, reading his book Outage and stuff,
yeah.
It's obvious that he, like, has a lively, literary, interested, curious, and bold kind of a mind.
Yeah,
so
he was a former rock musician.
I'm happy to hear that. It would be very disappointing if Bruce Powell was kind of frightened by your bad reputation into, like, I'm kind of interested, but I better not.
Here's an interesting point. Two points. First of all, he's a former rock musician. You know, before he went back to school in the late 70s, probably get fed up with the music world, and that's when he got into McLuhan, and he was attracted to McLuhan, even though McLuhan was basically suppressed at that point.
Right.
And there was another thought. I can't think of it. So I'll say in the Thompson quadrant, the book that McLuhan had by Thompson, Imagination of an Insurrection, says... Bill Thompson wrote to Marshall, to Marshall McLuhan, from one crazy Irishman to another, signed Bill Thompson. So it's interesting,
yeah.
Thompson is picking up the crazy thread to be the crazy man of the 70s, as McLuhan's
right.
star faded. What else about Bruce? Okay, so he did...
Well, I wonder if he... it's his earlier book. It would have been interesting if we could know exactly when... Maybe you could ask Thompson, maybe he knows when it was that he wrote that and sent that to McLuhan, because that would be an interesting kind of peace gesture if he was like, oh, crap, this media reviewer tried to paint me as the next him, so I'm going to send him a note that's more like, no, I feel like I'm on the same side as you and not, like, the new you or something.
Well, we won't be getting any response from Bill Thompson for me because he has reported that he thinks I'm crazy.
Right.
So it just goes from one crazy guy to the next, and they don't
right.
talk. They do not connect. This is the... The anxiety of influence that Harold Bloom developed as a literary theory. So I want to just read a couple of notes here.
Okay.
I'm going to post on Dupes your email to me with all the details for those that are interested.
Cool.
You have here in page 52 of Thompson's book, McLuhan writes, Germany and Ireland, oral atavistic. And then he says there's a 2,000-year cycle versus Plato, nativistic, cliched archetype. Then he says, now here's where the Gnosticism comes in. On page 54, he says, theosophy, myth, and bullets versus aesthetic solipsism. Now that's a direct explanation, a categorization of the dialectic in Thompson. Aesthetic solipsism could be Gnostic.
Yeah.
Theosophy, myth, and bullets. So... I think McLuhan's saying that the guys who tried to be political were Gnostic themselves, leaning towards the theosophical side with bullets versus the apolitical or non-political aesthetic solecism as the other kind of Manichaean Gnosticism. That could be what this division is, because normally you wouldn't divide theosophy from aesthetic solipsism.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess the division is more of a, is it being used to just enhance your own detached kind of contemplation, and wow, this theosophy gives me a great inner experience that I don't connect to anything, or is it inspiring a group political action? Because, yeah, the reference in that is, I think this was in the email, yeah, it was, that Thompson... in the Thompson book, he says, he's talking about Yeats and Yeats's vision and the other poet A.E.'s vision, and Thompson says, one poem of Yeats's is worth looking at in its entirety, for it shows how theosophy, poetry, and ancient Irish myth, through the alchemy of imagination, are being fused into the... I'm just stumbling over my own writing. That how theosophy, poetry, and ancient Irish myth, through the alchemy of imagination, are being fused into the alloy that will later be made into bullets.
Right. Let me read what you wrote here in one of your lines. This phrase, oral atavistic. What atavistic is sort of retrieving needlessly ancient forms. Isn't that what atavistic is? Like nostalgia... Like Terence McKenna.
Yeah, like barbaristically primitive.
Yeah, it's celebrating the noble savage for industrial man, or celebrating Paleolithic mushroom-eating man that McKenna does. So you say this weird annotation is hard to figure out. You go, the page is about Yeats growing a more mature attitude towards conflicting social roles, whereas early Yeats exhibited a more romantic dash idealistic rejection of such conflict. Now remember, Thompson is leaving the United States because he's doing the early Yeats. He's rejecting the conflict that the Vietnam War is bringing to American society. He wants to get rid of it. He doesn't want to jump into it. Then one sentence, a quote by Sorokin, who I think was a favorite of Dr. Beter's. He told me about Sorokin. This sentence is underlined, and this is underlined by McLuhan, right? And Thompson is saying Yeats instinctively felt what the sociology has observed that, quote, the individual has as many different social egos as there are different social groups and strata to which he is connected. Now that would be quadriphenia if you elevated that to different media environments, which have as their subset social groupings. But that's interesting, picking up on the quadriphenia there, or noticing what people are really. Then you have McLuhan wrote in reference to oral atavistic, both the German and Irish nativistic movements shared not only folklore and pagan myth, see, that's the theosophy, and then he adds, but theosophy as well. And both countries created the messianism of the elect out of feelings of national inferiority. But in the language of theosophy, the Messiah is known as the Avatar, and for every Magnus Annus, that's every cycle of 2,000 years, there appears a new avatar. That's in theosophy. And McLuhan underlines Wagnerian, or Wagner, that means the composer, underlines Wagnerian friend. And then he says, in whose castle Yeats had his vision. So you're seeing McLuhan tracking the Gnostic threads that he is wants to be in any environment to. And this is what he's noticing in Thompson's book, by going into the Yeatsian thread. And you got a lot of other really good quotes here. But back to what you had just read to me, could you just say the last line again? I'm not sure if I got your point or what was being said there.
Oh, that the theosophy, myth, and bullets?
Yeah.
It was Thompson's line was, he talks about the Valley of the Black Pig is the Yeats poem that he quotes in its entirety. This one poem is worth looking at in its entirety, for it shows how theosophy, poetry, and ancient myth, through the alchemy of imagination, are being fused into the alloy that will later be made into bullets. And then, but then Thompson then goes on to say, But all this violent activity is, in theosophical terms, on the astral plane, in that fluid situation that working on the film of the material world fixes the images of things to come.
Excellent. That's very interesting. I'm very tempted to bring Ion in to comment on that, because many people would project Ion as in the astral plane. Mm-hmm. And we'll do that in a few minutes. But the what else? Is there any other points?
Right. Well, just a couple sentences before that, because the context was he was talking about Yeats had his own vision when he was saying that that McLuhan underlined that it was Yeats's Wagnerian friend in whose castle Yeats had his own vision. And the other poet, A.E., had a vision. And Thompson talks about how it's odd that Yeats never mentioned A.E.'s vision, even though he borrowed the content of it to present in some of his literary work or something, that it's strange that he never mentioned A.E.'s vision exactly, because Yeats's theory of visions was that the vision is greater than any one person, and different people get fragments of it, and that, you know, part of the, like, a philosophy of an art community, and to not just be a solitary artist, like go be a hermit and never talk to anybody to refine your art, that the reason, the philosophical impetus to build a community out of it is that the vision comes to different people, and different people get different fragments of it, and that you have to bring all those fragments together in order to artistically birth the great vision into the world. You have to get all these people together. And a couple lines.
Yeats claiming that he did that?
Well, Yeats, apparently that, because Yeats has a book called A Vision,
yes,
which is about his own vision, but I assume that in that book he, like Thompson says, that's Yeats's philosophy of vision.
Yeah.
That description of it needing to be brought together. And a couple lines before the one I just said, Thompson says, on a much more when he's talking about the different visions, and it's strange that Yeats didn't mention A.E. because his theory was blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Thompson says, on a much more mundane historical plane, these visions are important, for they show that the messianic ideology of the poets and dreamers is beginning to have military implications.
Excellent. Now, I would, you've done great work on this stuff, and I'm looking forward to posting it on Dupes and anywhere else, probably on fivebody.com, if you don't mind these notes. I'm just wondering, they told me that you can use these notes for personal use, but you definitely can't sell it. But would posting this in Fivebody violate the copyright nebulosity of the Ford book? I'm not selling it. I'm just putting the information out. So,
I don't think it would.
Yeah.
I think I think that the proof that it wouldn't is that I was able to go in and see them. I think that if I was a student at the university or faculty at the university and that it was in that capacity that I saw them, then we might want to pause. But I'm just some schmuck who showed up and, you know, they circle the external thing on the card, as in this person's not affiliated to anything. He just shows up and says, hey, I'm a McLuhan geek, can I look at them? So if I, a nobody, am allowed to look at them, then what I found in them should be postable, I would say.
Okay, good. All right, so I'm going to see, since we're talking about visions, which is what is a big theme here in Iondom, I mean, people call anomalies and epiphanies, Ion claims to be the expert or appears to be the expert on this, so I'm going to ask Ion, is there something, welcome Ion, is there something you could add to why Yeats's vision is not acknowledging A.E. Russell's vision, two mystics in Dublin that influenced James Joyce to a degree? Do you have anything to add to that, Ion?
It was a bitter battle.
Very bitter. Very bitter.
So words that were right made the other wrong. So any words that were wrong made the other one right. So you vindicated the veracity.
By ignoring the other guy. You had to ignore him.
Therefore, nothing flowed.
Right. So what do you...
Joyce was the hot button.
You mean there was a battle over Joyce's young mind? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, I was trying to craft it.
Right. Because he was obviously the genius among the next generation. At least they saw that, right? They saw him as the one that would do something
well,
with
no,
him.
Well, no, they didn't know what he was. So therefore they were scared of him. So they supported him because they were scared. It wasn't
right.
He was all a bag of chips. It was that no one else was.
Right. So, hey y'all, but no, nobody's unmuted yet. It's just Brian and me.
We know.
So, what is the difference in AE and Yeats's vision? Is it just a
Peter
personality? yes, you have recommended some video on Beater, and that's I just saw that email, right?
Or do you mean masturbation?
Organic robotoids
are real. And that is that's
but
something but Dr. Beater, okay.
But you explained the difference between your two nutty, psychotic, psychosics that are battling for here and yon over.
Well, he talks about the corporate socialists versus the state socialists. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
These two guys can be fit into those two sociological mindsets or memes?
Within and without them. Within and without them.
Okay, so that's right and left in simple terms. Yeats is
right
and
left. It's a liberal Tory.
Oh, okay. So AE would be liberal and Yeats would be Tory?
And they intermingle. See, that's the thing there. They're like confused homosexuals. They're pitching and catching.
Well, is a bisexual person confused?
No. They're just very amorous.
So, Brian, did you have a question?
How about an autosexual? They just like themselves.
Oh yeah, they're increasingly growing their ranks. I've noticed today with the porn availability, masturbation has come back to be respectable. So Brian, is there an aspect of mysticism or vision realities that you like to relate to Ion and the AE and Thompson in the middle between Yeats and Russell?
I guess not really. I mean, if Ion had something kind of specific or crucial to say about this whole idea of different people having different fragments of the vision and needing to bring them together, maybe, but I'd rather ask Ion about because part of my theme in choosing certain books to look at is I'm trying to look into to get some juicy background on McLuhan's ideas about the conspiracy or secret societies or something, and that's part of why I look at the Velikovsky, because part of McLuhan's conspiracy ideas is acknowledging a kind of a natural academic conspiracy and the idea that, yes, new discoveries will definitely be shut out if they don't reinforce the center margin specialist thing. But, I mean, is there a particular book that I should look at to find what I'm looking for in there?
Very atavistic of you to look in the past to find the future for the background of that that was, that is, and yet that no one caught on to then.
Okay, that's cool. You've been classified. Now, can you address his question?
Well, we just did. Is there a book that talks about then from a posthumous history that was about now?
He doesn't mean that. He's saying, is there a book that McLuhan owned where his footnotes and annotations would show his interest and categorization that he got out of his fascination with secret societies, which not wrote but owned, would be in the 5,000 book library where Brian would find the annotations?
They are no longer there.
Did Eric grab them?
He did.
You know what to ask Eric next time, Brian, when you see him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have been surprised to go through the whole thing and find that there was nothing really relevant there and then to think to myself, damn it, there was something.
So, Marshall, is Eric embarrassed about that image of his father? Being interested in secret societies? Is that why he's hiding them? Or is he himself a secret society researcher?
Palimpsest.
Palin. Sarah Palin? Or is that
no, Palin? No, Palimpsest.
What's that? What's Palin? What's that, Carol? Is that biology? Palimpsest?
Like a palindrome, a both-handed prefix?
Oh, maybe he means palimpsest, where you erase and write over. Do you mean palimpsest, Ion?
We don't call it that, but okay.
Yeah, where you write over. So Eric wants to write over Marshall's notes.
Hmm.
Are you going to say do to that, Ion?
We did.
All right, good. All right, so, but to erase that area of Marshall's interest, see, this, I think Eric plays that down, the conspiracy, the secret society part.
how very commandeering of him.
Okay, so we would ask then, what McLuhan? As he looked into secret societies, was a reality that he knew was there, or was it a figment of his imagination or his paranoia? Were there secret societies in academia and in politics that he was looking into? Would you validate what he was looking for? Not that he validate what he thought about it, but are there secret societies?
Yes, there are.
Right, even in university culture.
Especially.
That's where they're, what, Ion? Finish sentence. That's where they are fostered?
Carry on.
Okay, Brian.
Well, I was going to say that in the particular letter, I think two letters that are in McLuhan's published letters, a couple letters to Pound where he's particularly freaking out about this issue. And freaking out is really the way to put it. It seems like I'm just wondering where he got this idea. He seems to have just discovered or just realized that particularly it doesn't necessarily seem so much like there's a conspiracy and there are secret societies out there now dominating this thing so much as it was he's freaking out about how much of an influence his favorite poets have allowed the rituals of secret societies to have on their writing, and that they've encoded that, you know, one of the keys to understanding some things in Pound and Joyce and stuff has to do with the Masonic rituals or Golden Dawn rituals. So, I mean, what he seems to be freaking out about in those letters is more the influence on his favorite poets and the idea that this influence is all over the arts. He seems to be a bit ambivalent about whether he's talking about secret societies influencing things in a political suppressing sense or just in a kind of artistic content sense, like you guys are letting your art be dominated by
Ezra,
what these guys.
Ezra was a freak. That's all it was. It's all back to hot and cold. It's all back to hot and cold media. Everything had to go in one bucket or another, and all the synapses that you're trying to ease into doesn't fit in either, so therefore it can't be. And that's the battle.
So the battle is over the influence of Ezra Pound.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the freak. Eliot and Joyce are more balanced or more indifferent to the secret society.
You'd have to ask Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah, definitely Lewis. I mean, I often think that it's Lewis that influenced Marshall and the secret society. Would you agree with that? Yeah, it's the Lewis influenced Brian.
Right.
You know, it's called, the phrase is Freemasonry of the Arts is the phrase in Apes of God.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, and in one of those letters, McLuhan says that he's like, W.L. Wyndham Lewis said to me that the secret of success is secrecy, and I thought he was joking. Turns out he's not.
Yeah. So, let's see. What about Velikovsky, Ion? Is Velikovsky's vision accurate, as he presented in his book, about evolution being punctuated and accelerated by collisions, solar collisions?
We think so.
You don't think so?
No.
You have talked about in the past comets coming by and doing things to the planet, I think. Didn't we talk about that years ago?
Yeah.
But it didn't affect evolution.
Well, we see, all was going on real good to get the stargazers and grave diggers. And it all went off the chain then.
Yeah, that's the beginning of visual space, which, quote, I say in the latest Roxy video, I said in Cambridge, is that when you start to map the stars, that's when writing in visual space started, and that was a further trap, a sensory trap. Is that what you're saying? Is that when they start to create a framework around their environment, their nature, that's the mistake. That's a further fall?
It is.
Yeah.
And see, you take the simple work like Ages of Chaos, it changes everything.
Ages of Chaos. That's a book, a simple work by somebody? By Velikovsky or...
Yeah.
Oh, is that a title by him, Brian? I don't know.
Yeah.
It. Oh, okay.
I think that was his second book.
Akhenaten.
What'd you say?
Ages of Chaos.
Now, what are you saying about that book? That's a ridiculous notion?
That's where this is the answer to what you asked, if there was some relevance to the work that would apply. That takes you from Exodus to Akhenaten.
Ages of Chaos. And is it accurate?
Better than most of the other crap he did.
Oh, okay. Okay, you're favoring the early book.
Well, because it was pure. It was pure, and everything else became ridiculous. I mean, look,
okay.
Have you read it? You're asking me questions. Have you read his ridiculous
work? Oh, no, I don't read.
Precisely.
So
like, is there a book I'm not going to read that's a part of the topic that I don't know what I'm speaking about? Because in an empirical world where we're trying to endiacally apply all the knowing that was known from a knowing place, depending on what these other dead motherfuckers have to say about being a motherfucker that didn't agree with motherfuckerism, and the other motherfuckerism that applied to this reference from that position that was transcendently imposed from the psychic from a way back.
Yes, but we have Brian here. Brian has read more about this than me.
It changes everything.
Yeah, that changes everything. I'm just a facilitator here. But you don't...
A mandate, as it were.
Right, I understand that Ian does not agree with the evolutionary thesis of Darwin. That is not
what's
how...
Wrong? What's wrong? Why can't we support something that's just wrong?
Well, what is a vision that's correct? You begin with there's no time. You have to start there, right? There's no time, and then imaginate something from there, if you can.
Well, you know, it's not even imaginating anything. It's that you put things in a cyclical spool that begins and ends, and it doesn't. There is no string theory. If there's a string theory, the theory has to be strung. Well, that means it has to start and has to end for it to work. It doesn't work that way. Within and without. You take a piece of macrame, and follow the twine. Very difficult to follow it all the way through because it doesn't end. It just goes through and through and through and through. And it becomes each part. Each vestigial part becomes a part of the whole. So the threads that are bound together, cords, as it were, bound cords can't be chased. So it makes a flat net, not a linear space. You're calling space time, and it isn't that at all.
Is the macrame making linear time, or the opposite?
It's the opposite. It's where you're trying to follow the flow that doesn't follow. And that's the same problem with your time. Let's take a very fine set of sheets, linens, and you take the threads that make that weaving, that make that wonderful, beautiful damask material. The thread isn't time. The space that it creates isn't linear. The thread is the thread. It is just co-joined in an eternal web, as it were, that makes a cover, which can then be moved, changed, shifted. So if you look at it that way of changing the sheets, time doesn't apply for sure.
Excellent. And what's that phrase you say, the thread leading the sewing, or the sewing leads the thread? What's that phrase often?
Sew, and then we say a needle pulling thread.
Yeah, needle pulling thread. So, Brian, that was excellent little statement there, Ian. Aren't you impressed by his vision, Ian's vision?
Aren't I impressed?
Yes, you. You, Brian.
I find it fairly hard to follow, and maybe that's just a
linear response.
we'll go get a book from the 50s from some ridiculous person and tell you to go read that book and look in the footnotes and something buried in a peat bog, and it'll be all clear for you then.
Yeah,
right.
And look at that, Brian. He said, buried in a peat bog, a direct reference to the midden heap in Finnegan's Wake. You see, Ian does that. He's a very good composer. He has his motifs he refers back to.
Oh, no, I mean, I guess what I mean to say is more of a, but I don't really know what to respond. I mean, it reminds me of something I heard lately, someone passing along something Stephen Hawking said about when people talk about whether the model corresponds with the reality, they've got it a bit turned around, because that presumes that there is a reality separate from the model, but everything that we think of as reality is what we think of as a model of it.
Excellent.
People do not know what they think what they know.
No, what's the first part of the sentence? Drowned out. Who's he and I?
People do not know what they like. People like what they know.
Yes. So he said that's a non-nominalist point of view. He took a McCloon view there. The communication evokes the... am I starting to be sabotaged? You're crackling, too.
Raining.
Anyways, am I still crackling, Carol? Okay, just a minute.
Nope.
Bubble. So the thing that what Hawking said there is the grammarian rhetorician view, not the dialectical is nominalist, that the symbol is not the reality. This is what Alan Watts and Krishnamurti and many of the New Age gurus are nominalists. Whereas McLuhan says, how can I know stone without the word stone? How can I know the model and the reality without the model and reality evoking
you? You know it's a stone when you take and bash your skull in with it, and you know it's a stone, but
yeah.
Not until then. So there you go.
It's funny, because it was only hearing that he'd said that makes me have the whole, maybe Stephen Hawking really is smart.
Yeah, maybe he is. Well, he's a little, he's rapidly changing his view due to us. He listens to us, and that's why he dropped the black hole idea. He's been influenced by us. That's why he started talking
about the catastrophic vacuum delay. That was the phrase I really liked he talked about lately, that there could be a catastrophic vacuum delay spreading at the speed of light, and it would cancel the whole universe, and we wouldn't know it was approaching. I love that phrase.
Yes, well, he is paranoid, getting the best of him. He is trying to understand Ion and fit it back into his conceptual interests, and that's why
it all gets cleaned up with a nice episode of Squidbillies titled God's Bro.
Yes. Squidbillies. You know Squidbillies, Brian? You aware of that?
I know I've heard the name before, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, Google that. It should be, or YouTube.
And watch it, all of it. It'll explain it all for you.
Okay. Yeah, not just put it into Google and then walk away from the computer. I actually watch it.
Right.
Okay, well, Brian, I think we'll bring in some other voices. Right. You're welcome to stay on the line and keep the themes going that you're interested in, but your work is outstanding, and I think that the dupesters will love it when I post it, your notes.
Don't read it.
Ian will not like it. Ian is not interested in human activity too much lately.
Oh, I know.
Go read a book.
Especially
Brian say something.
Someone thought years ago. I get it.
But no. What did you say, Brian?
I'm just saying, you're saying he's not interested in human activity. I'm saying, yeah, especially not scholarly to figure out what someone meant by what they said 50 years ago. I get it
if you were a previous teacher or mentor or something, is that you engage Ian, because once Ian showed up, the whole game got changed completely. And actually,
we're much more interested. We are much more interested in your vicissitudes that you go through to create these platitudes that put these people on these dead things that's so important that it takes your energy to be intrigued by them. We are much, much more interested in your creations rather than their derivation.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, I need an excuse to,
What is your excuse to do what, Brian?
Yeah, we know what you're going to say. This is what Brian's saying. Excuse to do what, Brian?
There's a call for submission from Steam Shovel Press for a new edition of their conspiracy newsletter. So I thought if I could whip up a good McLuhan versus the conspiracy thing with new background on those letters to Pound and stuff, then that would give me an excuse to submit something.
To create something.
Get my name in print. So
he's studying this stuff for creation purposes, Ion.
Beater, beater, went to town.
Yeah. So the... okay, so what we're doing here, Brian will come in every other week. That gives him time to get to the library and find new stuff. And then every other week will be Katie Thomas, and we'll come in with her post-Ionet researches. Katie is the first Ionet to get to post-Ionet status. So she'll be coming in, and many Ionets are into Beter right now, so Ion's aware of that. They're studying Dr. Beter. You know that Dr. Beter caused this phenomenon to happen in many ways. Did you know that, Brian?
The Ionic phenomenon?
Yes, Ion is a product of Beter. Without Beter, it wouldn't have happened.
Okay, so it's kind of
We thought it was LaRouche with the queen putting thing in his bum.
No. Let me just mute Ion just for a second so I can get Brian to hear something. You haven't heard the story of how Beter did it. You don't know that story, right?
No, I guess not.
Okay, very quickly, because we want Ion to come back in. But JW was seeing ghosts, many ghosts. Then one day, he says to me, a ghost came and said his name was Dr. Beter. Do you know him? I said, yes. And he said, well, Dr. Beter said, say hi to Bob. So I got the idea from that. I wasn't interested in talking to the ghosts around JW, but when I heard the Beter was there, I thought the ghosts were the Evergreens. So I thought, well, I can talk to the Evergreens. I'd done them before. So the next day, I attempted to talk to the Evergreens. Well, it turned out I was talking to Ion. But the idea to talk to the ghosts around JW would never have occurred unless Beter came and said, say hi, Bob. And I know Beter knew that would have that effect, and therefore we have to give Beter great credit for creating Iondom, which has changed everything. Everybody's been changed. Now I will.
Cool. So in a way, Beter is also the ground of the whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah. I've been a bit worried that maybe Ion was just, you know, repeating the name over and over again to emphasize the punny masturbation context of Peter Beter is just wanking.
Yeah. Peter Beter. For those who don't know, penises were often called a Peter. And then you beat it. But I missed the first part. You thought Ion was repeating something?
You kept saying, Peter, Beter.
Yeah. See, he's listening, Ion. He's noticing.
Peter Beter went to town.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Yes. Okay.
You want a book, you want something to write, that'll write.
You mean to write about Beter, how he went to town? You suggested that topic? Yeah, okay.